at the seventh commandment, and here it is in the 14th verse of Exodus chapter 20. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Now, we looked at this, and we talked about, well, why is adultery such a sinful sin? Where is the greatness of its sin? And first of all, I told you that because it's a breach of the marriage oath. Now, simply to breach the marriage oath, in the sense of violating the covenant, though that be very bad, I mean, you've lied, you have committed yourself to a person, and often you have defrauded the other person, and that's terrible, and it's probably a violation of at least a couple of other commandments. But the thing that is worse about it than even all of that is that it brings death. It brings death to the family. And that's the trouble with much of our society. Because of a violation of this seventh commandment, and a violation of it with all glibness, you know, well, you can't expect anything. In fact, I was reading an article the other day where some psychologist, in fact, I don't think it was a psychologist at all. It wasn't. I think they were quoting some actress. And some actress said, well, monogamy was never, you know, just for one man, one woman, that's not natural. It was never natural. It should never have been. People change. Well, it's so glib. But it brings death. And not only death into the family, but then death into society. Death into our culture. Death into our community. I told you a number of years ago, I was invited to be a part of a panel, and they recorded us. And they were going to take this recording to some, I think, studio in New York. And we were going to be invited to be on some kind of show concerning homosexual marriage. And, of course, the fact that we stood against, or that we don't believe that that is proper. In fact, that that is contrary to the Word of God. And so the woman who was asking, there was a young black man doing the filming with a camera. And the woman said, well, you know, what is the problem? What is the problem with this? Why would you be so adamant against this? And of course, you know, the quick answer is that because God forbids it. But why would God forbid such a thing? And I said to her, because it brings death. It brings death into a society. It brings the judgment of God on the society. And there's no way that a society could propagate. If everyone now decided to be a homosexual, then the world would be over. You can't live consistently to it, you see. You have to get out of what you say you are and what you say you believe in order for life to continue. So we see the death of it. It brings death not only to that person in the sense of physical death, that's the end of him and or her, and spiritual death, they will stand before the judgment seat of God, but it brings death into the family. It destroys the family, and it destroys society. So why would we as a society promote something that is so hideous, so obviously wrong, and the consequences of it so devastating? Well, I don't think she liked that answer, but I noticed that the young black man holding the camera began to nod in agreement with me when I made this argument. Well, again, homosexuality and the practice of homosexuality is simply one aspect of fornication, one aspect of adultery, one aspect of violating this commandment. And indeed, let me just say that that homosexuality, and I think we should surely be careful in the way we speak, that we should speak about it from a Christian worldview, that homosexuality is not a condition. It's an action. It's not a condition. We should not talk about people as being homosexual. No, these people participate in homosexual sin. They are not, in the sense, in a condition of homosexuality. And we must be careful to understand that. Because you see, when you give them that point, then you must give them the point, well, this is what I am. This is the way I'm made. No, this is not what you are. And this is not the way you were made. This is what you chose. In violation to God. Well, again, adultery in every sense of that word is exactly the same thing, and it brings death. It is a breach of the marriage oath, and it brings death and destruction to the persons who participate in it and to the family. And that's why the death penalty in the Old Testament was applied to it, because it does bring death. The second thing, the greatness of the sins lies in this, that it is in the face of God. Now, I guess we could say all sin is in the face of God, but this is a specific sin that the Lord says, thou shalt not commit adultery. And the adulterer sets his will above God's will. He tramples upon the commandment of God. He affronts God to his face as if the subject could tear the prince from the throne. The adulterer is highly injurious to God, to the Father, to the Son, and the Spirit. Now, thirdly, the sin of adultery lies in this. It is a sin committed with mature deliberation. This is not just something that happens in the sense of anger. You become angry. Now, I believe that there's a condition you can become angry and sin not. But sinful anger, you may flash with sinful anger. Or in the striking of someone, something may happen and your temper rise so quickly that it's not a deliberative act. In fact, if you had deliberated on this, you would not have done it. But it's a quick response. But not adultery. It's a conniving act. It's a lying act. It's an act that is committed with deliberate, constant consideration. Uncaring whom it hurts because of a moment of your sick and perverted pleasure. Because first you contrive it in your mind. You contemplate it. You think upon it. And it begins to burn in your mind until it comes to your will, and your will then consents to it. So now your mind and your will have come together. And then you make an advance toward another person to convince their mind, to lead them into this path of sin. Adultery is a sin doubled. And so you lead them down the path to where they will contrive it. Their will consent. And then there is the act. The gall of such an act that could have been stopped at a million places, a million times, but you push forward. Even a discussion of it among the adulterer and the adulteress, saying, this is not right, this is harmful, this will hurt, this will destroy, this is something that can never be taken back. Though a man be given many gifts, he shall not consent to them. So what about the children? Who cares? But yet if the marriage is destroyed, if the home is broken, they will be scattered to the wind, and then there will be a great chance and a great opportunity that it will be sowing the wind and reaping the whirlwind in their lives. But who cares? I must have what I desire. It's a sin against the light of nature. Regardless of this actress who says that monogamy is not natural. In fact, monogamy is the only natural way. Because God made Adam and Eve. He made two. You say that is the senselessness of homosexuality. You see, if why are there two in marriage? Well, I mean, it's obvious, right? He created them male and female. So there are two. Now, once you do away with male and female, then what is the next? What would be the next casualty in such a war? Well, the next casualty is two. Why should there be just two? I mean, if it could be, why couldn't there be three or six or 12? Why couldn't they be, you know, I mean, and today I might consider myself, as they say in society, and it is so absolutely senseless, so hideous to our own logic, so absurd to our own thinking that it's almost laughable to say it, but at one moment a person can identify as a male, the next moment as a female. And the courts give consent to such foolishness. And it will come, let me say this to you, it will come full circle. It will snap back and it will take their head off. It cannot stand. It cannot stand, first of all, because it is contrary to the law of God. God is in heaven and he will stir from his holy habitation and he will come and make it right. And Sodom and Gomorrah scream out that to us. It's not just a Bible story that we tell the children to take up some time in Sunday school. No, it is the fact. And God will avenge his honor and his creation. And here are these people in his face, deliberately sinning against nature. We know it is against nature. For we know that when we do such things, when we forsake the law of God, and when we give ourselves to multiple sexual partners, it brings disease and death. But not only is it against the light of nature, but it is so effective. It is so effective in its devastation. It is like dye to wool. When you put this dye to the wool could never be pure again. Never. No matter how much, I mean, you say, well, we have Clorox, we have these, chlorine things that can displace color. It can displace color. It can displace almost every bit of it, but it will still leave it tainted. Again, that which makes adultery so sinful is that it is needless. It's needless. Why does a man or a woman need this? God indeed has provided for us a remedy. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 is one of those chapters I go to when someone comes to me and says, well, we would like to be married. So this man and woman, we used to didn't have to say that so definitively, but now we have to say it very definitively. When a man and a woman come to me to be married, and I talk to them concerning their marriage, I go to other passages, but I always come to 1 Corinthians chapter 7 because it's so contrary to the thinking of the world. Well, here the Apostle Paul says to the church at Corinth, and God saying to us, now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me, it seems as if they had written Paul a letter asking him some issues. I mean, how shall we live now that we are a Christian? Paul was used of the Lord to establish the church there in Corinth. Brother Gerald made a reference to that. In this city I have many people. And so here the church is established. They're writing back to him. Now, of course, there were false teachers that came in and other people that came in and tried to lead them down other paths. But the Apostle Paul says, I've espoused you to one husband, even unto Christ. And so he is taking claim over this church, and rightly so. So they write to him. They say, what do you think? Well, the first thing he says, it's good for a man not to touch a woman. There are certain conditions in men, certain gifts from the Lord, that he's given a gift of celibacy. And so that would be good. It would be good if he could give himself totally to the things of the Lord. Nevertheless, there won't be many people that can do this. Nor should many people attempt to do this. Nevertheless, and you'll see in the King James Version and maybe some of the other versions, you'll see to avoid is in italics, which means that it was supplied by the translator. It really, there is not a Greek word that that can be translated to avoid, so they put it in italics to show you that it was just an added word to try to make it read better in English. But literally, the Apostle Paul, when he wrote, he said, nevertheless, fornication's obviously the larger sin of sexual immorality, and the Ten Commandments surely does, in the Seventh Commandment, include this as applied. But there's fornication. There are appetites that every man and every woman have, with rare exception. So let every man have his own wife. Now this is a reflexive pronoun here in the Greek. Literally, let every man have the wife of himself. And let every woman have her own husband. Now this parallels in the English, but in the Greek it is not paralleled. In the Greek, a man has a wife of himself. That is, from him, one with him. He reflects her, she reflects him. But when it came to the woman, let every woman have her own husband, means the word here means to possess him, to own him in the truest sense of the word in English, own. Now, when I tell people this Greek word here, almost everyone gets a kick out of it. I know that Danette Chancellor gets more of a kick out of it than anyone I think I've ever seen when I told her this word, but and she obviously, in her quick wit, had to make some statement about it. But literally, for a woman to have her own husband, the word own is idios, not idiot, idios. But it does sound very close, doesn't it? Well, so Danette said something like, I'm supposed to submit to this idiot. Anyway. But it's her own husband, the one she possesses, which is interesting. It's interesting in the context of where they were in the culture. Surely interesting that a woman basically in the Roman Empire was less than nothing. In fact, you can read in some writings of the ancient philosophers, including Aristotle, of how they relegated women to basically a necessary evil. How unlike the Bible. We have modern feminists today that said, well, the Bible puts women down. The Bible doesn't. No, my friend, the Bible is the only book that lifted women up. And here it says, she owns him. And interesting. She in the Roman Empire, who could have no possessions at all without a husband, the Bible is saying she owns him. He is hers. So let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. In other words, to give her everything that she needs. Literally, it's a sexual context, but it surely can be applied to every context. And likewise, also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body. Would the modern feminists agree with that? Would the judges who found some mythical understanding that a woman has a right in the Constitution, it's not there, it's made up, broadcloth, and she has some right to privacy that extends over her body, so she has the right to destroy and to kill the intruder called the infant child? Or the nascent child? Well, it's my body. Well, when you give it to your husband, it's not. It's his. Unless you want to argue with the Word and with God. And many do. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. So, I have been asked by people, is marriage a 50-50 proposition? And I say, no, it is not. It is 100-100. So you give yourself to her, she gives herself to you. What does that mean? That means you as a wife stop looking after your own interest. You give yourself fully to the interest of your husband. And husband, you give up your interest. You are now consumed with her interest. Now you immediately see the danger in that, don't you? You immediately see the danger in that. I mean, I can just hear now some woman saying to me, wait a minute. I'm not sure I'm in for this. Or some man, well, why should I do that? Well, the only reason I can see why you should do that is because God told you to, and there's life in that and death in the other. So you see, if a woman gives her full interest to her husband and the husband gives his full interest to himself, she's surely left out. Or vice versa. If a husband gives his full interest to the wife and she gives her full interest to herself, he's left out. But you see the beauty, the wonder and the beauty of what the Lord has created in marriage. Even as Adam looked at Eve and said, "This is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and cleave unto a wife, and they two shall be one flesh. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer." So there may be a time when a man and a woman doesn't give themselves to each other, but that should be only for a spiritual reason, and it should not be long and come together again. The clear implication of this verse is come together again quickly, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. Now here's the reason that you do that, that Satan tempt not. Satan is always for the Christian, always around the corner. He is always present with his temptation. Always present, surely temptation for the sinner. But we're talking about the Christian here, the one who desires to live a life pleasing to the Lord. You do have an adversary called the flesh, but more than that, one called Satan. And he will tempt you because of your incontinency, because of your lack of control. Now we're told here, this is what we should do. This is how our control is maintained, how our appetite is fulfilled. We have our own wife. The wife has her own husband. So you see how needless it is? Not to mention that adultery takes what is not his and gives it to one, if married, possessed by the other. It is a sin of needlessness, a sin of robbery, a sin of perversion, a sin deliberate and mature. And it's inexcusable. It's like a rich man, a rich thief, stealing when he has no need. Now, someone probably would not be angry for someone who was hungry to steal bread. But a man who is wealthy, you remember the parable, Nathan comes to David. Nathan says, "Hey, there's this man who owns 100 sheep, and a visitor came to visit him. And instead of killing one of his sheep, he went and took this poor man's only sheep, his only lamb, and he slew it. And he and his friend ate it." And David says, "Tell me who that man is. For God do more to me. If not this day, that man shall die." And Nathan said, O King. You're the man. You're the man. Our hideous and needless is such a sin. And how wonderful it is that God has made provision for us, that we do not have to bring death and destruction in our paths. For he that hath found a wife has found a good thing. Let's pray.